But when I moved my mom in, I certainly felt, okay, now I'm off the market. I've got a broken down house, a crazy mother, a high pressure job being a vegan activist at PETA. This is not really a good resume for finding Mr. Right.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. We have a favor to ask. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, could you please rate and review Species Unite on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts? It really helps people to find the show. Today's conversation is with Dan Matthews. Dan is Senior Vice President at PETA. He started working there in the 80s, right when he graduated from college. He was a receptionist. These days, 35 years later, he is the Director of Campaigns and known for some of the most controversial attention-getting campaigns anyone's ever seen, including the I'd Rather Go Naked Than Wear Fur ads. He just came out with his second book. It's called Like Crazy, Life with My Mother and Her Invisible Friends. Dan, thank you so much for being here. I'm really happy to have you on the show.
Sure.
So I want to talk about Like Crazy and the years that you write about in the book. But before we get there, I want to talk about the decision that you made to move your mom in and how that all went down.
Yeah, I mean, I should start by saying that I really don't consider myself much of a family man. I moved away from California right after high school, saved up $1,000, lived in Italy, always volunteered for animal rights until I finished college, started at PETA in Washington. And I would see my family. My mom and dad split when I was about 7. My brothers remained on the West Coast. And my mom was very kooky. Growing up, she was always involving us in whatever cause, whether it was marching with immigrants or the grape pickers, just you name it. You know, she was tear gassed marching against the KKK. And when animal rights became my thing, she totally embraced it. And she was really champion of that. And even when I was gay in the 70s in junior high school, which was a kind of a death sentence in that era, she totally backed me up in that as well. And told me I was a part of this really cool subculture. And so she just, you know, a lot of kids have a lot of problems growing up because their parents don't support them or their parents have other ideas with what they should do with their life. And my mom, with all of her quirks and drawbacks and eccentricities, was always solidly in my corner. You know, when I had friends that, you know, a few friends contracted AIDS and their own parents turned them out, she would take care of them. And she was always so great. So flash forward, you know, I'm about 40 years old and my mom is, you know, approaching her 70s. And I could tell that things were worse with her. She always had these emotional moments. She would move to a different town, change her name all the time. She ended up in a Salvation Army at one point. My brothers and I would take turns getting her apartments. And I finally decided I had to see her out the way she saw me in. We just have to take a deep breath and move her in. Bought an old dilapidated 1870 house here right across the harbor in Portsmouth, Virginia. And it was, my friends told me it was the worst decision I would ever make because not only would I have a crazy full-time job at PETA, but it's a full-time job taking care of a senior with health problems and mental problems, and not to mention the house that was about as broken down as my mom was. But I just, you know, I knew I would always regret it if I didn't just buck up and do it. And so I did. And it was really fun at first. As the years went on, I had it for about 5 years. I would walk in, and she would be having these conversations with people that weren't there. And I thought, oh, maybe this is just how seniors reminisce. And it all seemed very good-natured. And I thought, well, this is nice. This is pleasant. But then it started getting darker and darker and darker. And then my brother was dead. And then my father was dead. And then our newborn niece was dead. And she just thought everybody was dying. And she kind of spiraled out of her mind. And I lured her out of the house and got her to a hospital. And she was admitted and diagnosed with schizophrenia, untreated schizophrenic, all the way into her 80s.
How old was she when she got diagnosed?
82.
Does that happen?
It does happen, but it's extremely rare. And it's never written about. You know, when she was diagnosed, I read all the other memoirs about schizophrenia, and the most recent one from, I think, 2012 or something like that, had said that all of the memoirs, all of the books, all the scientific data on schizophrenics come from those who have gotten treatment fairly early on in their teens or their 20s and were observed in clinical settings. There has never been a book about how the untreated disease would manifest in a person who made it into old age. So I thought, study here in a clinic? I lived with the bitch for 5 years. I can tell you everything you want to know. So I really felt it was my obligation to write a book that was shattering stereotypes. Luckily, my mom was a very, very witty, hilarious individual. And so this was able to be a funny book, even though it's about mental illness. But it took me a good 5 years to write it and finish it after she passed. And now it's been getting really, really terrific response.
Schizophrenia gets such a bad rap. It's all dark. Everybody, it's all just violence. And that's all you hear about it and see about
it. Right.
One of the things about your book I thought was so incredible was it's this very real story of what life can look like. And I'm sure it was dark times, but you know,
yeah, like Curry,
but there's a lot of good times as well. And on top of that, because we live in a culture where it's so easy to put people away when they get old or they get sick, that you made the choice not only when everyone was telling you not to, but when it really didn't fit in your life at all.
No.
So what was it then that ultimately made you decide, yes, of course, I'm going to take her in?
Well, life does not make a plan.
No.
You know, you might make plans, but life doesn't make a plan. I wrote the book not only for people suffering mental health or people dealing with those who are suffering mental health, but also as something, a different take on a parent-child relationship. Would I have gone to such great lengths to bring her in if she hadn't inspired my animal rights work when I was just a child and she was urging me to look up for animals, if she had defended me so staunchly when I was gay and gay bashed? And, you know, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But the fact is, I know a lot of people that have to reinvent themselves, not just gay kids, but people have to reinvent themselves after they leave home, after they get out of college, when they're away from the shadow and influence of their parents' expectations. And that can drive a wedge that lasts a lifetime between some people. I mean, you're good friends with your parents, but it's still like, you know, arm's length. And I didn't have that excuse to fall back on, which is why I listened to my heart and moved her in.
What you've done with your life, what you've done with PETA, what you've done with animal rights, gay rights, versus a lot of kids growing up in that same position with a different kind of parent, who knows how you would have turned out? Do you think a lot of this came from your mom's influence, her pushing you to just be who you are?
It's true. It's totally true. And, you know, there was drawbacks. When I was kids, you know, schizophrenics don't have a great track record at managing money or maintaining human relationships. So we would have to move apartments a lot, one time in shopping carts because we had no car. But when you're living that situation, it doesn't seem pathetic. It seemed like a game and it seemed kind of funny, especially when we had to move the piano four blocks in the middle of the night, up and down curbs and speed bumps. My first memoir is called Committed, and that's all about what happened that compelled me to devote my life to animal rights. And my mom is a significant character in that book, especially in the early parts. And she was everybody's favorite character, despite there being, you know, Pamela Anderson and Calvin Klein and Pink and Paul McCartney, whatever. My mom was the person that everybody asked about the most because of her outlook and her hilarious quotes. And so when it was coming time to figure out a second book, it seemed like this could be an extension of Committed, but really just about her. And especially because it coincided with all of these things coming, you know, into clarity at the end of her life and all these answers. You know, our parents often don't tell us the things that happened to them in their early life because they don't want to load us down with their baggage. And then, you know, it's important for us to learn, especially if what happened explains the way that they're, you know, a little bit damaged, I suppose.
When you were growing up, did you know something was up? I mean, clearly she was different, but she hadn't been diagnosed with anything.
She would refuse to go see a psychiatrist. She turned her nose up at the whole thought of it. And of course, years later, after she died, my dad said, I didn't know what exactly this was, but she refused to see anybody. And it's what drove us apart. And it's what drove her apart from her previous husband in the 50s and from a few boyfriends here and there. And, you know, schizophrenia is a very simple disease in that it is a surplus of dopamine in your system. And when you've got too much dopamine in your system, you get a blocked signal. The signal from your ears to your brain about what you heard or what you thought can get all muddled, especially in times of, you know, emotional tumult. And so when somebody who is schizophrenic hears a plane crash outside, they didn't think they heard a plane crash. They heard a plane crash. There was no exterior speaker. It was their own self, right, you know, that conjured that up through the mixed signals in the brain. And I learned early on, the big mistake is to say, you didn't hear a plane crash. Look outside. There's no plane. All of those times, it would end in fights and slam doors and more, you know, misery. I learned that you just say, oh, how awful. God, what do you think we should have for dinner? You just have to acknowledge it and move on.
When she got the actual diagnosis, were you relieved, shocked?
I was shocked. It was one of the biggest, maybe the number one shock of my life, because my brothers and I, all three of us are college graduates. We watched the news and we grew up with her and we knew something was really wrong, but we chalked it up to damage from her growing up in orphanages and foster homes during the Depression. All those years that she wouldn't talk about, we just assumed some awful thing happened and that's why she's kooky. And so we just don't press the subject really. The diagnosis, it all made such sense. And then I went and reread Committed, my first book, and the descriptions of her are all the descriptions of somebody suffering schizophrenia. And I can't believe I didn't recognize that. You know, schizophrenia, even though it's simply too much dopamine in your system, it's a very complex disease with how it manifests. Some people hear voices, other people see images. My mom heard herself singing more than she heard other voices. She couldn't turn off her own poor voice singing Christmas hymns or whatever. And so it drove her nuts. And it's all slightly different. There's dozens of different versions of schizophrenia. So there's not really one true disease, although there's the one true cause, which is the surplus of dopamine causing just your system to go haywire with, you know, internal communications.
It had to have been just a crazy shock to hear after this many years.
She stopped recognizing me at one point when she was in the psych ward. And that was really a terrible thing. But then with minimal meds, the voices disappeared. They turned into, I think, faint echoes. And for the last, you know, several months of her life, she lived at home, died at home. It's why I bought the house, was for her to die in it rather than in some antiseptic hospital ward or awful senior place. And so I was most proud the day she died. You know, it's like, I think this book is very much about helping somebody that you love into the grave. And, you know, when you're raising a kid, it's all about the firsts, their first walk, their first word. And, you know, as you can sense that your parent is going to be gone, it's their last Halloween, it's their last this, and you really want to do it right. You know, I've never had hangups about death. I guess having grown up in the AIDS era, I was never overwrought by the idea. You just want to make it as pleasant as possible and be strong for the person that's actually dropping. And that's another reason why I think the book has so many funny elements, even though it's darkly comic, is because I've always thought that, you know, when you're the person who's kind of taking care of somebody, if you show that you are a wreck, that's only going to make it worse for them. I think, I'm not saying you have to ignore bad things that are happening. I certainly don't do that. But at the same time, you have to laugh at the absurdity of life. I mean, to give you an example, on her deathbed, my mom, there was a hospice nurse who came in every day. And at one point she said, have you two had a discussion of the inevitable? And my mom with the oxygen mask on said, oh yes, when my time comes, I'm going to hold on to a Thursday because on our street, they take away the trash on Fridays.
It certainly didn't get boring. Well,
no.
And you thought too that by bringing her in and moving her in, you're like a lot of your parts of your life were kind of done for a while at least. And right?
I certainly loved having a boyfriend here, a boyfriend there, traveling with PETA. I had, you know, just I was all over the place and it was fun. And I loved being a loner and, you know, traveling all around and having a little tiny apartment base here in Virginia. But then I pass 40 and I'm feeling this, you know, I didn't feel any great need to, you know, find a partner or anything like that. I think it just has to happen or it doesn't. But when I moved my mom in, I certainly felt okay, now I'm off the market. I've got a broken down house, a crazy mother, a high pressure job being a vegan activist at PETA. This is not really a good resume for finding Mr. Right, but who cares? I didn't do it for this. And I this is now a different part of my life. I kind of decided I'm no longer going to be the wild gadabout that I was because I've got different priorities right now. And that could change. That could change. She might last 5 years. She might last 15. Just who knows? But the strangest thing is that only 7-8 months after I moved her in, I met this guy, Jack, at last call at a total dive bar here in Norfolk. And he had just separated from his wife of 19 years, had 4 teenage kids. He was my age, but he had 4 kids. And he was just entangling himself from that and hadn't really even come out to his broader family yet and was really depressed and really struggling and felt that he was past the sell-by date himself. And so we both met at the most vulnerable, desperate moment in each of our lives. And he came over and I was like wary of introducing him to my mom at first. And they instantly clicked. He had been an orphan as well. And so they had the orphan bond. My mom was so pro-gay that she ended up becoming his like surrogate pro-gay mother. And he just instantly fell into the routine at our house. And because he's a production designer for indie films and reenactment TV, he was actually able to help pull the house together in ways that I could never have done. And then within a year or two, he moved in. And then we had the base of the book is this great, bizarre, new modern family of me, my crazy mother, my freshly out of the closet husband, his Latina ex-wife, and their 4 kids. We weren't all living together, but me and Jack and Perry were, but all got together quite a lot on holidays, and that was the ongoing thing.
Yeah, I mean, what a lesson, though, and you'd make this change, and it looks so like it's going to be so hard, and, you know, it was hard, but it's such a life changer in the other way, and how much it just blows your life up in the most incredible ways.
Yeah, I think it's like you know, whatever, if you follow your heart and doing the right things, other good things will happen. If you go derailed from your path that you're supposed to take or for self-interest or greed or something like that, it might keep you from getting the life that you should be leading. And, you know, Jack was not even vegetarian. He was Mr. Ham and Cheese when we met. And my mom and I've been vegan since the 80s and she has since the 90s. He got so into the wild dinners that we would cook that he's like, you know, I'm going to make all the things that I used to make for my kids, but vegan versions, spaghetti and meatballs. And so his whole thing was like recreating all these meaty dishes, but with the vegan versions. And we just had these wonderful dinner parties. And then because we live in a big ship town, a big Navy town, we have a lot of friends. And, you know, a Navy town has a lot of tattoo artists and tattoo parlors and a lot of strip bars and a lot of rough and tumble people that are here, you know, working on a ship for a month before they ship out again. A lot of them in the Navy, PTSD victims at the Naval Hospital around the corner. So we have a pretty eccentric town and our dinner parties reflect that. You would not think it was a PETA senior vice president having these dinner parties with tattoo artists and strippers and sailors and my deaf mom at one end of the table telling dirty jokes and you know, Jack and I turning all these people on to vegan things that had never even considered it before. It's a rare, I think, especially in this day of such fragmented society, we're so divisive right now, this country, is we somehow thrive on everybody being a bit different. We had a hunter come over for a vegan Thanksgiving after he had hunted that morning. And he didn't tell us that until later. I knew he hunted once in a while, but he didn't tell us that until later. And now the same guy is posting about vegan this and vegan that and inviting us all to his parties and to make things so that his friends can, you know, learn more about it. And it's just, it feels like this is the way it's supposed to be. You can have friends from all different persuasions, political persuasions, different sexualities, different, you know, at our house, we just don't care. You know, everyone, it's a true melting pot. We're very involved with the NAACP and the Black Lives Movement over there. We successfully toppled our Confederate monument this summer. I'm very, very happy to say.
Congratulations on that.
Jack and I were there helping lead the charge on the first night with Onyx and Bob and Louie and all the others from the NAACP. And so, yeah. And now they've learned more about PETA and we're doing this food desert veggie giveaway together. And it's just, you know.
How cool. What a beautiful life. And go back for just a second, because I want to hear about how, like, specifically animal rights became, you know, that she had this influence on your life in animal rights.
So that only hit me when, after her diagnosis and when reading about the traits of schizophrenia, I just thought she was a loner. You know, she would work for temp agencies, quit jobs pretty routinely, move to a different town, change her name, just like, it was just odd. But I learned that that's just a hallmark of schizophrenia, is you cannot maintain long-term relationships with humans. However, she maintained long-term relationships with animals, because every cat on the street who was stray, we would take in and get them vet care, and usually they would stay. And one time we took in a pregnant cat who was being attacked by kids under a bush, had six kittens in my closet that night. And, you know, and this was a white trash apartment where there were no animals allowed. So she just taught us at such a young age that animals are these pure spirits. They have not only different kinds of sophisticated intelligence, but different ways they can communicate, and different way that you can really consider them a friend, and they'll consider you a friend if you just really treat them like an individual with respect. And so that was drilled into me. That's the only thing I've ever known. I never had to unlearn, you know, disregard for animals. Of course, back in those days, it was before PETA's, before animal rights really was seen as a movement. You know, I would still go fishing with my dad the few times a year I would see him, until I finally renounced fishing when I was about 12 and decided then and there that I was never going to eat fish again. I was so embarrassed that I had actually killed an animal just from peer pressure going fishing with my dad. And then slowly but surely, of course, I, you know, stopped eating pigs and chickens and cows, and then I went vegan in 85, the year that I started at PETA right after college. And 35 years later, here I am still.
And what made her go vegan?
She always thought it was sensible. It was just not really practical when we were growing up in the 70s. We would get Hamburger Helper. It really wasn't on the radar, aside from, you know, some hippies were, but you just didn't really hear that much about it. And as soon as I decided that was me, she totally encouraged it. She wasn't one of those parents who said, oh, you're going to get anemic, you better, well, as long as you're under this roof, you're going to, none of that at all. She's like, oh, that's great. I'm going to do it too. Why were we ever eating meat in the first place? So this is all when I was in, you know, junior high school. So it started then. We were both vegetarian. And then after I started working at PETA, I became vegan. And then as soon as she learned more about the dairy trade, that she became vegan as well, quite easily. This was all, you know, in the seminal years of PETA, so it's kind of interesting to see. And there's a lot of PETA in the background of this book, you know, different trips for different campaigns, and with our stray cat situation, and the wonderful, it ends with our cat Cilantro, who was a stray, she's a Manx, a giant cat, like a bobcat, who roamed the streets of Portsmouth after a neighbor moved and left her behind. And my mom was constantly trying to get this cat in. This cat would go near nobody. But after my mom died, all of a sudden, this Manx reconsidered and, you know, is now a part of our family still.
I love it. I love it.
25 pounds. And believe me, she's on like the low-cal kibble and she doesn't eat that
much. That's awesome. Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Everybody should read this book. It's incredibly funny and incredibly good, but it's also, I mean, there's so many lessons. It's just how to live and how to really create a beautiful life.
I really appreciate that.
So thank you for the book. Thank you for your work at PETA. Thank you for all of it.
My pleasure. See you next time.
To learn more about Dan, about PETA, and to order either of Dan's books, go to our website, speciesunite.com. We will have links to everything. If you like today's episode and you have a spare minute, please do us a favor and rate and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps people find the show. We are on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. And if you'd like to support the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it. We're on Patreon. It's patreon.com/speciesunite. I would like to thank everyone at Species Unite, including Gary Knudsen, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, Santina Polke, Gabriella Sibilska, and Anna Kollner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day.